my generation to service. It was the beginning of a great journey, a time to march for civil rights, for voting rights, for the environment, for women, for peace. We believed we could change the world. And you know what? We did. But we're not finished. But we're not finished. The journey isn't complete. The march isn't over. The promise isn't perfected. Tonight, we're setting out again, and together we're going to write the next great chapter of America's story. We have it in our power to change the world, but only if we're true to our ideals. And that starts by telling the truth to the American people. As president, that is my first pledge to you tonight. As president, I will restore trust and credibility to the White House. I ask you to judge me by my record. As a young prosecutor, I fought for victims' rights and made prosecuting violence against women a priority. When I came to the Senate, I broke with many in my own party to vote for a balanced budget because I thought it was the right thing to do. I fought to put 100,000 police officers on the streets of America. And then I reached out across the aisle with John McCain to work to find the truth about our POWs and missing in action and to finally make peace in Vietnam. I will be a commander-in-chief who will never mislead us into war. I will have a vice president who will not conduct secret meetings with polluters to rewrite our environmental laws. I will have a secretary of defense who will listen to the advice of the military leaders, and I will appoint an attorney general who will uphold the Constitution of the United States.
Shut the hell up, Carrie. This nonsense about how you and your generation changed the world. Yeah, you're right. Now we have the World Bank, the IMF, Structural Adjustment, GATT, NAFTA. It changed the world, all right. It created a hell out of this world. And then you babble on about how you're about to write. You and your Democratic colleagues are about to write the next great chapter in this American story. Oh, you mean like the next great chapter, more Hades, more Iraqs, where a million are dead through your Democratic partner's sanctions, more Vietnams, more dropping of the A-bomb on Japanese, more American slavery, more genocide of the American Indians? Well, actually, you're still completing your manifest destiny. The whole world's turned into a giant Indian reservation. It's time that we start killing the Custers. You know what time it is. Slave time. Check this out. You're listening to 104.1, 101.1 Santa Cruz, 106.7 Illinois, LUVER.com, the World Slave Revolt Time. Tonight we're going to shoot our way into a ruins of empire as it deals with how it's declared a travesty that an NFL player wants to retire. And a take on Sharpton and other clowns in the Democratic Party speech in a Beyond the Shadow segment. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more on 104.1 Slave Revolt.
Auctioning slaves is a real high art. Bring that young gal, Roy. She's good for a start. Bid 'em in, get 'em in. Now here's a real good buy on about 15. Her great-grandmammy was a die-homie queen. Just look at her face, she sure ain't homely. Like Sheba in the Bible, she's black but comely. Bid 'em in. Gonna start her at 3. Can I hear 3? Step up, gents, take a good look, see. Cause I know you'll want her once you've seen her. She's young and ripe, make a darn good breeder. Bid 'em in. She's good in the field, she can sew and cook. Strip her down, Roy, let the gentleman look. She's full up front and ample behind. Examine her teeth if you got a mind. Bid 'em in, get 'em in. Here's a bid of 3 from a man who's thrifty. 325, can I hear 350? Your money ain't earning you much in the banks. Turn around, Roy, let him look at her flanks. Bid 'em in. 350's bidding, I'm looking for 4. At $400, she's a bargain, sure. 4 is the bid, 450. 5, $500, now look alive. Bid 'em in, get 'em in. Don't mind them tears, that's one of her tricks. 550's bidding, who'll say 6? She's healthy and strong and well-equipped. Make a fine lady's maid when she's properly whipped. Bid 'em in. 6, 650, don't be slow. 7 is the bid, gonna let her go. At 7, she's going, going, gone. Pull her down, Roy, bring the next one on. Bid 'em in, get 'em in, bid 'em in.
Seekers everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
We're about to go into Ruins of Empire, even though the introduction's a Beyond the Shadow segment. But nevertheless, what we're going to start off with is a few days ago, former Miami Dolphin running back decided no more running for him on Master's Plantation, that being Ricky Williams. And now you've seen the onslaught of the corporate media, coaches, and even fellow slave players feeling that they've been betrayed by Ricky because Ricky doesn't want to run no more. We're going to explore that and some of the dynamics of what does it really mean to run in a league and in a game that's as dangerous and brutal as professional football. But first, let's check out some of the things that the actual coach had to say about this whole process, and then we'll take it from there. So check this out.
And why? Because And you've been here. Everybody here has pretty much followed us from when we reported in March. You know, Ricky showed in a pound or two lighter than he left at the end of the season. He was in great shape. He did not miss one practice, did not miss one quarterback school. We had a team meeting on the 22nd of June, on a Tuesday morning, 21st or 22nd of June, and he was in the team meeting and participated. So, yes, I'm totally surprised.
If you're involved in any kind of team activity, I don't care if it's a business, I don't care what it is, and you do something like this, it's the ultimate act of selfishness. I mean, let's be honest. If he would have done this at the end of the season, that would be different. I can be, okay, you know, the guy's just tired of football. That's all right. But doing it right before training camp, let's just call it what it is. Also, and say he's quitting. I mean, it's just ultimate. He quit on us. He quit on us. It's his teammates, and it's just frustrating.
That Seth McKinney sound courtesy of ESPN Radio. No team depended on a single running back more than the Dolphins did of Williams last season. Ricky accounted for more than 80% of his team's rushing attempts. Williams' 392 rushing attempts last year were the most in the NFL. Travis Minor, who'll probably take over, had 41.
All right, so first you hear the coach talking about how shocked he was. He didn't have any indication, as if a player is supposed to give some forewarning. Now, if you look at it in professional sports, when they cut professional athletes, they don't give them any forewarning. You just find out through your agent that you've been hacked and you better go find yourself another job. And it's just that simple. And the fans' attitude is the same way. If they see a player who basically is looked upon as a product, like a beast, an animal, a thoroughbred, if that thoroughbred loses a step, they're already looking at other thoroughbreds to replace them. Because the whole outlook is the machinery of the team and what's the best interest of the team. It has nothing to do with the individual health of any of these players or anything. So when you hear one of Ricky Williams' former players saying that this was the ultimate act of selfishness, this also shows how conditioned, even people who use their labor for a living, because that's what professional athletes do. They're using their physical labor and talent to make a living. How mind-controlled they are. Here, every time you turn on the TV, you hear about these corporations outsourcing jobs off to India, off to Bolivia, off to, you know, anywhere under the sun where they can beat down people for, you know, 30 cents an hour to make Nike shoes. Now, how is that not part of the dialogue of what's selfish and what's truly barbaric? Because, see, the reason why I mention this, none of these players on Miami's team, none of the coaches, none of the fans, that's not going to hurt their pocketbook at all. No one is hurt monetarily by Ricky Williams leaving, except he's not going to make it as much because he's not playing anymore. But that's a decision he made for himself. So Ricky Williams decided not to play football anymore, basically because he wants to walk 10 years from now, should be looked upon as a decision that any adult may want to rationally make. But when corporations intentionally slice the legs off of people permanently from being able to put food on their table by sending these jobs to outsource low-wage, high-repression areas, that's truly affecting people's lives. That's truly making a difference on will your kid be able to live in a community that is not toxically chemicalized all up. But see, in this mind-controlled a country that we live in, that's not even part of the discussion. It's all on the laborer, you know. It's all on the product, the thoroughbred, who is this supposed to run and run and run until he can't run anymore, and then he's disposed of and kicked off. Now, a few years ago, there was a player for Houston. What was that player's name? The running back for Houston, the real big player that was strong, Houston Oilers, legendary. Earl Campbell. Earl Campbell can't even walk anymore. He can't even get out of bed without help. And that all has to do with the way that football players and running backs in particular are viewed. They're viewed as a product that you just run into the ground, take as many snaps as you can get out of them per game and per year, and then by the time they hit their 30s, they're about through, and you just kick them off into the wilderness. The average fan forgets about them. And they have to live the rest of their lives on crutches or, you know, taking all types of chemicals and all this nonsense just to get, just to make it through the day. Williams decides, I don't want to go through that. And this is viewed as him being a traitor. These fools are out of their mind.
Yeah, they run this, as usual, out of proportion to its importance. Let's face it, where do sports really sit in the scheme of things for the working people of America? You know, I'm afraid that people have been sucked into an unworthy cause if it's dumping on Ricky. Because, you know, they, several articles in the paper, and not all the same, by the way. In Oakland, the sports writer that did the special on this compared him to the other Ricky, the baseball player, who's playing and he's, what, 43? And he makes the point, that's a choice. If your body's in shape, if you can stay with it, Ricky Williams, right? Ricky Henderson is the baseball player. Thank you. And, you know, it just shows how twisted. The player that denounced Ricky earlier here, you know, we heard, if you think about it, he's the one that's selfish, because why does he want Ricky to play so bad? Because he know with Ricky, he got a good chance of winning. Ricky is good.
With that whole mentality that you're supposed to give everything.
That's right.
Nothing else. Your lifeblood. Right.
That's right.
And your whole view as a player of what's worthy as a human being is the same thing that is, it's the same way that you're supposed to hold, the fans are supposed to hold you as valuable.
Right.
In other words, your health's not valuable. Your family's not valuable. Everything else is secondary to some gladiator sports arena type of activity. And right there, if you buy into that, your whole perception of the world and what is important to you,
what matters,
will be off kilter.
That sure will.
And the corporate media is feeding into that whole process by bagging on a 27-year-old cat who just said, look, football's too confining. I want to do some other things with my life. I played it all my life since I was a little kid, you know, and it just doesn't fit me anymore. You know, I've grown out of it. Now, can't someone make an intelligent decision like that without being... Now, in an intelligent society, they could. That's just the problem within this decadent society.
Yeah.
Now, next, you got some simple-minded, sensationalistic ESPN buffoons question Dan Levitar on Ricky's departure. So let's see some of the questions that they ask, and we'll take it from there. Dig this.
Dan Levitar, the man who broke this story, joins us now. And right off the bat, why did Ricky do this, in your opinion?
Well, it's not my opinion, it's his opinion. The football is just mundane at this point. It's not interesting enough to him. It's common, it's small. He's done it for a long time. It's limiting, it's confining. It's not the way he wants to spend the rest of his life. He's not like other people who want the rock star lifestyle, like the fame and the fortune. He's like, look, I was happy when I was poor. I don't need all of this. So he wants to go do things that are more interesting. He's been reading a lot of philosophers lately. He just wants to do bigger things with his life.
You know, it's funny you mentioned the rock star lifestyle. He just came off of tour with Lenny Kravitz in Europe and said that he found the celebrity stifling while hanging out with Lenny. But then again, he was on tour with Lenny enjoying that rock star lifestyle.
Well, no, he got to watch it. He got to observe it without being burdened by it. What he noticed the whole time, he said, Lenny's always in makeup. He's always doing an interview. He's always getting his hair done. He's always doing things to please other people as part of fame's burdens. And I know nobody wants to hear about this. They don't want to hear about how burdened the rich and famous are. But he just saw that and saw, look, I don't want to be shackled that way. I want joy from my life. I want to squeeze the feeling that football gave me the first time I played it, back when I was an amateur, back when he was just enjoying games. He wants to go back and learn things anew. Football just too small for him at this point.
All right, what about the fact that he admitted that he has been drinking a masking agent to hide his marijuana use? How does that play into his retirement?
Well, not very much. I mean, he said that it played a small role, just in it reinforced that he doesn't belong in this world. of football with all its rules and all its rigidities. You know, this is, I understand that people like to seize on the sexy parts of a story like this, but this is the most common thing in the world. Baron Davis told me one time that 80% of the NBA is regularly smoking marijuana. You're very naive if you think that these drug tests that these leagues use about things that aren't performance enhancers are meant to do anything other than make it look like they care about the problem, give the perception that they're policing it. If 80% of the league, by one estimate, of the NBA is using marijuana, you've got guys doing it pretty regularly and not apologizing for it.
All right, what about his social anxiety disorder? He hasn't been taking his medication. How does that play into it? Is Ricky now comfortable in his own skin?
Yeah, no, it doesn't. He hasn't taken it for a long time. He's more comfortable in his own skin than he's ever been. This has been a confused kid in the past, but he is a grown adult now, and he is happier than he's ever been. As I told you, that was a very hard thing for him to do in Australia. He said it's one of the hardest things he's ever had to do in his life, dancing on a dance floor by himself without worrying about the judgments of others. He could always be perfectly confident running into a stadium full of 80,000 people because he was perfectly confident in that skill that he had. But now, he's confident in everything. He's stronger than ever. He said he never had the courage before, never had the strength to not play football because everybody thought it was what he should be doing. Now he says he's found that strength.
All right, well, Ricky Williams, now a guy who is a former NFL player, Dan Levitard, the man who broke the story. Thanks a lot for joining us, and I'm sure we will talk to you in the coming days.
Now, I'm sure that a lot of people didn't like to hear the fact that Williams considers football mundane, confining, small, limiting, and stuff like that. Because, see, the way this culture has developed and has sensationalized entertainers and entertainment as being the top spectacle and the top fulfillment of your life. So for little kids playing all these little video games and all of that, you know, these TV video games 18 hours a day, that's supposed to be the fulfillment of a lifetime. And being involved or watching athletics, not using athletics to know your body, develop your body, and try to maintain a good physical condition and balance between your mind and body for the rest of your life. No. Just getting caught up in the whole spectacle of sports, competition, defeating your opponent, you know, and all of that. And so football often becomes metaphors for all of these war stuff that we see going on. You often hear these raggedy politicians like Boy George, who's never been in real enemy lines in his life. He was too busy going AWOL, using metaphors about these football metaphors about scoring a touchdown against the victims and the terrorists and all of that type of stuff. By the same token, when Williams talked about how he's, you know, he's been using a masking agent to hide the fact that he, you know, smokes up a little now and then. First of all, the Negro shouldn't be telling these people nothing like that, because they're always going to try to use that to denounce his character.
Steal his money.
And say that, see, really he's just a zip coon. He just wants to sing and dance and, you know, and frolic and all of that type of stuff. He doesn't want real responsibilities. So they'll just harp continuously on that as if he has not left football for other priorities, his own health, trying to maintain his knees, because like he said, he was down in Australia, met Aborigines, you know, had discussions with them about that. He's been reading a lot of books on philosophy. The brother's just trying to search. I mean, is that a crime? Dang, this is ridiculous, you know. But this is the way it is in this society, and they'll just harp. So they're not so much harping on Ricky, in my opinion, per se. They're using Ricky to harp on the kids coming up, that don't be a loser like him. Be a winner like Earl Campbell, even though he can't walk. But he's still a hero, you know. That's what you want to ascribe to. And when I'm mixing the war stuff, that's the same thing that if a brother says, you know what, like Ali, I have no problem with the Viet Cong. I'm not going over there. in American culture, that's a loser. That type of athlete's a loser. Tillman, who puts on his G.I. Joe uniform, quits football and goes over there and gets his behind shot off by some in Afghanistan, that's a hero. In other words, friendly fire, but he still got shot up over in Afghanistan. But at the end of the day, what it's all about is following the principles and guidelines of the status quo state and how they see fit for you to use your human resources and labor, etc. And that is not often or ever in your own best interest. Ask Tillman.
You know, a lot of people don't understand, for instance, how being involved in sports and organized sports on a serious level can eat up your time. I've been fortunate enough to play on a college level and a high school level. Now, this is not professional, but I can tell you, these people gave us a diet. When I played football, we used to have a special diet. We had to eat. You had to go to practice. You had to run 3 miles earlier in the day. Then, you know, I mean, just on and on. Gymnastics, while I enjoyed it more, was very demanding. We practiced every day. Roughly 3 hours. Now you count it up. That's a lot of time to be practicing. Now we became, you know, the high school, we became champions of the city. Yours truly was fourth on the high bar. I just thought I'd mention that. Nevertheless, that's a decision to make and for you to make, you and you alone. You don't need a whole lot of other people getting up in your mix telling you, no, it's easy. Get on in there. 3 hours a day, professionals probably have a much more rigorous schedule. Well, a lot more demands on
it's them. More encompassing because it's diet, year-round training nowadays. You know, you have to be wary of certain activity off-season, things like that.
Can you go play a basketball game? You might hurt yourself.
Worry of different injuries, things of that particular nature. But also interesting is that, you know, there's a new book out, and it's about one of the top teams in the late 70s. This is like in South Central L.A., and it's a team with Daryl Strawberry on it. It had all these brothers on it, and the brothers were this raw dog bad. Strawberry wasn't even near the best of them. Now, we know about Strawberry because he's the one that made it. The reason why I mention that is even Strawberry admits that he wasn't even near the best of the players on the team. But see, this is how it gets into some of the social political dynamics. Often, the best athletes in the black communities don't make it because other things are pulling at you that may pull you off course. You know, the socioeconomic situations, death, drugs, like some of the players, they just didn't get along with some of, you know, they got recruited and stuff, but when they went to some of the teams and college teams and stuff like that, you know, the way corporate America plays some of these racial games, this whole ghetto pop stuff, like as soon as they see that you have some talent, they come slithering in. You're like 12, 13 years old. They start trying to give you Nike contracts and stuff like that. Now, people have heard me do the whole thing on Amari Stoudemire. And Stoudemire, he starts to get recruited and by Nike. Then Adidas is pulling on the other end. Now, his mom's in jail, his father who knows where, and he's caught between two people who are trying to more or less play the father figure. It wasn't really a father figure. It was just a manipulative figure. One is working with Nike. The other is working with Adidas. His mother, all she needs is $1,000 for bail, but they don't have $1,000. Nike doesn't, and Adidas doesn't. They didn't have it because they didn't want her out because they knew that she would assume authority and take the best interest of her son. With her son floundering around like that in no man's land, that left it that's more vulnerable to be manipulated by these corporations. Now, Stoudemire could easily have gone down the track that many brothers have gone down and just never heard of again. As a matter of fact, one of the coaches for, or one of the representatives from Nike actually tried to destroy Stoudemire when Stoudemire went to the school that wasn't a representative of Nike. He then, with the help of the other school, doctors the transcript of Stoudemire and make Stoudemire's grades look below a C average so he couldn't play that next year. So here they, it's like search and destroy.
You should go to jail.
You're with us or we'll destroy you. No interest whatsoever. And, you know, brother was 16 at the time and stuff like that. So many brothers end up getting this turned off from the whole process. Should it be any surprise?
Yeah, that's exactly what they do. And you know, no recourse, no outcry. I mean, because that's analogous to, you know, abusing a child, you know what I'm saying? I mean, from the corporations, I mean, what's different? Like you were pointing out about the brother who can't find a place to live once he get out of jail. What's that cat's name? He was convicted of rape. He spent all his time in jail.
Which one?
Some brother in Oakland recently. I mean, there's probably millions of, but.
Oh, I know who you're talking
about.
Yeah, that was a few years back.
Yeah.
Right.
No, it's a new dude. His name is Gary something. I forgot his name, but he's in Oakland, and they trying to run. Every place he goes to live.
Oh, they ran him off.
Yeah.
Oh, you're talking about the sex offender one.
Yeah. The sex offender.
Oh, okay, I thought you were talking about the one that we had helped one time who was involved in a cop watch, and then the cops made him homeless. By saying that he was a nomad when they kicked him out of the house. Well, basically what happened was his make this real quick. His sister was living with this guy, and his name was Gary, too. He was also living there. The mother was out of the house because she was in the hospital at the time. The boyfriend of the sister was a snitch to the cops. So he became friends of the cops. And one time, this boyfriend, who was a snitch for the cops, who was also a crackhead, caught the kitchen on fire. So Gary said, all right, blood, you're going to have to leave. That's it. You know. So then the dude didn't want to leave, so he ran and told his friends, the cops. So the cops came over and kicked Gary out the house. His mom's house. And then to make it like he didn't have any place of residence, on his arrest receipt, they wrote nomad, as if he's just wandering around. They came to his house.
Yeah, that's cold. You know, I was going to say that I saw a dude, a Hell's Angel today, right, on a motorcycle, and he had a tattoo on his arm, and the tattoo said, USA 31, World 24. And I guess it was the Olympics or, you know, something, you know, I don't know what it was referencing, you know what I'm saying, but it has something to do with sports. But, you know, the whole point is that, you know, the U.S., I mean, it's like this whole thing about competition, you know what I mean? If you don't want to participate and be competitive in this country, there's something wrong with you, you know what I mean? And the whole thing, I mean, they're in competition with the whole entire planet. The U.S. is in competition with the planet, you know what I mean? And it's like, the U.S., if you don't subscribe to competition, which is endemic to capitalism, you know, then you just good for nothing, you know, like Ricky Williams, you know, wanting to go smoke some weed.
Well, that has a lot to do with how the psychology of many of the things have developed in these capitalist societies. I don't want to go too far afield, but when you think about the term race, you know, people talk about, what does that mean? Because if you look, when you're talking about races, the term race has a meaning, and what they literally mean is a race. You know, when they're talking about black, white, red, yellow, the whole construct of them picking that name race means that they viewed all of these particular groups, phenotypical groups, in other words, color caste groups, being in a race. And of course, there's going to be some winners and there's going to be some losers. So it's not just an accident that they chose that term race in the beginning. Now, next, some ex-NFL players and a writer talk about the plight of NFL running backs in this day and age. So let's see some of the things they have to say as we tie this up on this Ruins of Empire segment. Check this out.
Isn't that the issue really, though, Rick? If you've got so many great backs, then none of them is really as valuable as they used to be when you had only a few great backs.
I think the window for paying the back is shorter. You look at what's going on in the NFL today. Once a back reaches 30, they're not going to pay him the money. You can take a good offensive tackle and pay him till he's 35, 36, 37. This league will not pay running backs after the age of 30. Emmitt Smith saw that, and Eddie George saw it this year.
You talk to coaches and assistant coaches and coordinators all the time, Rick. How has it changed the way that they perceive the value of running backs over the years?
Well, you don't want to pay big money to a player that's on the descent. You have to spend your cap dollars on the younger players. This league has become younger. Eddie George is certainly not an old man at 30, but this is the edge of the cliff for running backs in today's game. The production and the durability of backs drops dramatically after the age of 30.
Otis, you carried the ball quite frequently during your career, but now more than ever, it seems like when a coach gets his hands on a really good running back, he says, I'm going to run him and run him and run him until he drops. Has that changed over the years?
I don't think so. If you look at the running backs that are currently in the league, you're getting guys carrying the ball average of 300 carries a year. That's a lot. And then the guys that come out of college carrying the ball a whole lot. So that's why you have guys not lasting as long, or when they get to their 30, they seem to be on their way down or ready to get out of the league. Well, you got to remember, college takes a lot out of you, and then you come to the pros and you're running the ball over 300 times a season. That's a lot to ask these guys.
Now, there's a reason why after 30, these guys who are supposed to be in the prime of their lives, generally in professional sports, basketball, which is, you know, from a standpoint of athleticism and the whole cardiovascular type thing, that's the most demanding out of the major three. Yet, in basketball, players in their, you know, when they're hitting like 29, 30, they're right in their prime. Jordan was right in his prime during that period. But in football, it's downhill from there. And that's because of the major punishment that you have taken within that particular sport. Now, also, it also has to do with the way that the owners really have no regard for the players. Many of the fields are AstroTurf, which are extremely dangerous. It's basically carpet on concrete. And then you have a process, as one former Raider doctor who wrote a book describes. Look, they have hospitals bid to be the team hospital. Naturally, in a capitalist system, the lowest bidder gets the job. So if you're a hospital and you bid the lowest, you're going to want to spend the least amount of money on the players, and you're going to want to, in an effort to please the owner, to get the player back playing as quick as possible. So you're going to spend the least amount of time in their recovery, and you're going to do the things that are not going to help them in their long-term recovery. You just want their short-term recovery because, after all, they're expendable. So this is what a lot of players realize when they're in that whole gladiator arena. And some of them decide to opt out of the game. Ricky, keep on stepping. Oh, hold on a sec. Thank you.
The media. How many of you really believe that the media tells you the truth? The media. How many of you really believe that the media tells you the truth?
They lie.
IDS, solutions for a small planet.
You know what time it is now. Ventures in Corporate Media Land. And tonight on this segment of Ventures in Corporate Media, we're going to deal with a segment dealing with Negroes hollering for master. And that deals with Al Sharpton. And the other night at the National Democratic Convention, Sharpton was responding to some of Boy George's so-called questions and stuff like that. We're going to deal with some of Sharpton's questions, but also, just as importantly, the role and the response of the corporate media in trying to transfix and headfix the population into deciding how they should view what Little Sharpton said. So first off, let's hear Sharpton start off with his response to Boy George. Check this out.
Mr. President, as I close, Mr. President, I heard you say Friday that you had questions for voters, particularly African-American voters. And you asked the question, did the Democratic Party take us for granted? Well, I have raised questions. But let me answer your question. You said the Republican Party was the party of Lincoln and Frederick Douglass. It is true that Mr. Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation, after which there was a commitment to give 40 acres and a mule. That's where the argument to this day of reparations starts. We never got the 40 acres. We went all the way to Herman Hoover. And we never got the 40 acres. We didn't get the mule. So we decided we'd ride this donkey as far as it would take us.
You know, some of this stuff is like a minstrel show. When you hear Sharpton hooting and hollering and doing all of these Baptist cliches about, you know, riding some donkey all the way. I mean, first of all, no Democrat should even be able to hold their head up after the 2000 elections when, yes, the Republicans intentionally shapeshift black people primarily off the voting roll by using a voting fraud scam, using computer software that eliminated 90,000 plus people, majority black, from the voting roll. The story was broken by Greg Polish before the Democrat, i.e. Gore, conceded. Yet, the Democrats were more concerned about maintaining the integrity of the system than they were in exposing what their fellow Republicans had done. But this had not been the first time. There's a book out by Roy Morris Jr. It's called Fraud of the Century. Shows how these things work in cycles. And you know, in Florida, in 1876, a similar situation had happened where the Republican nominee, Rutherford Hayes, and Democrat nominee, Samuel Tilden, got involved in the state of Florida during the presidential election. And once again, you had a thing where it was obvious fraud, intimidation, lost ballots, racism, all took place. The whole election wasn't determined until 4 months later. Everything had been worked out between the two parties about who was going to have what power and so on and so forth. Both sides were stealing, using threats of violence and so on and so forth. Even some of the like in Harper's Weeklies, the Journal of Civilization, even their little cartoon posters of the day, like it has one of them, it says 1775 to 1776, liberty or death, you know, the whole, you know, liberty. Then 1879 to 1880, death of liberty. And then free shooting on election day. And it has a skeleton holding a gun. This isn't Zimbabwe. This isn't Haiti. This is on Sam's plantation, this madness was going on. And what ended up happening was through all of this fraudancy and theft and gunpoint, gunboat diplomacy and stuff like that, while the Republicans ended up quote-unquote getting the nod of approval after it all been worked out, they had made certain concessions to the Democrats, and one of them was the blacks in the South. And the black rights in the South went completely down the drain. And destruction of Reconstruction. The Reconstruction period was a period after the Civil War when black people started getting, you know, certain rights and so on and so forth. Not rights that either side really believed in. As many people have heard in my commentary, Happy 4th of July, and it was a lie, Lincoln himself said that if I can maintain the Union without freeing any black folks, I wouldn't free any black folks. But if maintaining the Union means I have to free some blacks, I would. In other words, maintaining the Union was more important than black justice, black liberty, black freedom. So get Fraud of the Century, and you'll see that before that time, during that time in 1876, and right now, we got a fraud going on. And whether you're riding on a donkey or an elephant, you're still heading over the cliff.
I haven't seen this particular book yet, but I know this. As we were talking about that Fahrenheit 9/11, and for me personally, one of the best parts of the movie was when they showed the black Congressional Black Caucus looking to get the support of one single senator so that the issue of disenfranchising the black people that actually occurred in Florida in 2000 could be addressed in the Senate. And not one came forward. Not one. And I think that's telling, quite telling.
That's why I say when you get the DVD, play Martin's speech, I Have a Dream, and then play Malcolm's speech, The Bollard or the Bullet, and then it's clear who's more relevant. The Bollard or the Bullet? Malcolm. Now next, Sharpton addresses who earned black folks' vote. Let's see Sharpton's version of the world. Dig this.
President, you said what we have for leverage if both parties got our votes. But we didn't come this far playing political games. It was those that earned our votes that got our votes. We got the Civil Rights Act under Democrat. We got the Voting Rights Act under Democrat. We got the right to organize under Democrat. Is our right to vote wasn't gained because of our age. Our vote was soaked in the blood of martyrs, soaked in the blood of Goodman, Cheney, and Swanner, soaked in the blood of Four Little Girls in Birmingham. This vote is sacred to us. This vote can't be bargained away. This vote can't be given away.
Okay, one of the dangerous things that happens when you get caught up in petty bourgeois politics is that they always try to phrase things in the parameters of victory with whoever happens to be the elected official and old party at the time. And this has helped lead a way to phrasing things as victory under Democratic leadership and under, and for the other side, Republican leadership. When, in actuality, black progress has always gained its most important missions under black organized development. The most important advancement black people have made in this country, for an example, was not during the Civil Rights Movement, it was during the Civil War, when Frederick Douglass correctly analyzed that the Republicans weren't our friends, the Democrats weren't our friends, but there was a crisis, an economic crisis in the economic order between the slave states and the ruling class and the slave states and the rulers who control people's wages and the slave states, the so-called free states, where you had to earn a wage. And they were battling over what type of country overall this was going to be. And Douglass analyzed through his North Star paper that it wouldn't be feasible for black people to go back to Africa at this time. It wouldn't be feasible for black people to be nonviolent at the time, because actually there was an abolitionist split between in the movement, where some abolitionists said that black people should not raise arms or anything to try to free themselves. Frederick Douglass's constituency won out the day, and 200,000 black people picked up arms to crush the South, not in any illusion about the North, but knowing that this would be a major stepping stone towards our freedom. So it had nothing whatsoever. As I mentioned before, Lincoln himself at the time was not looking at black people as being equal. He was looking at the survival of the Union. So no one in their right mind had any illusion about where the Democrats stood, where the Republicans stood, and all of that type of stuff. It was about independent, organized struggle amongst black folks and their supporters about what step best needs to be made. So while Sharpton likes to go on and on about what was accomplished, quote unquote, during a particular president, he'll leave out the whole movement that was involved basically in strangling the necks of particular bourgeois leaders at the time, and them more or less deciding that they would pass certain reforms, reforms that could easily be taken away if you're not organized in the future. And that's basically what is taking place. So Sharpton is just basically playing a charlatan role when he talks about what was accomplished under quote-unquote democratic leadership. Now, next, Sharpton goes into democratic family values. So let's listen to what Sharpton has to say and take it from there and see what that exactly means. Dig this.
Mr. President, in all due respect, Mr. President, read my lips. Our vote is not for sale. And there's a whole generation of young leaders that have come forward across this country that stand on integrity and stand on that tradition. Those that have emerged with John Kerry and John Edwards as partners, like Greg Meeks, like Obama, Barack, like our voter registration director, Marjorie Harris, like those that are in the trenches. And we come with strong family values. Family values is not just those with two-car garages and a retirement plan. Retirement plans are good, but family values also are those who had to make nothing stretch into something happening, who had to make ends meet. I was raised by a single mother who made a way for me. She used to scrub floors as a domestic worker, put a cleaning rag in a pocketbook, and ride the subways in Brooklyn so I'd have food on the table. But she taught me as I walked into that subway that life is about not where you start, but where you're going. That's family values. And I wanted somebody in my community. I wanted to show that example as I ran for president. I hoped that one child that come out of the ghetto like I did could look at me, walk across the stage with governors and senators, and know they didn't have to be a drug dealer. They didn't have to be a hoodlum. They didn't have to be a gangster. They could stand up from a broken home on welfare, and they could run for president of the United States.
All right, when Sharpton goes on and on about our vote, Mr. President, is not for sale. Maybe your vote isn't, but your soul is. Because you have a situation where basically Sharpton and them have been contradicted and imploded by their own contradictions. Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, their basic program, amongst other things like black capitalism and capitalism in general, is that if you put enough black faces in high places, mayor, governors, chief of police, that will trickle down amongst the community. So they sold this bill of goods. Now, interesting thing happened. When Amadou Diallo got shot up by four cops, a couple of them were all on drugs. Some were probably all roided out, which the black community has been trying to get proper testing amongst cops on roids. But see, once again, we're only supposed to be concerned about roids with athletes, not roided out cops. But nevertheless, you had a situation where during the court hearing, it was clear that the black district attorney was not going tough against the cops to convict the four cops that shot up Amadou Diallo. Amadou Diallo was a brother who got shot at 41 times, hit 19 times as he was trying to enter into his house with a key. And the cops say they mistaken his key for a gun, and it was his wallet for a gun, key, wallet, whatever. So many people turn to Sharpton and say, hey, Sharpton, what's going on? This is your man that you said we should vote for to become the district attorney in La Bronx to get elected, because under you and Jackson and Neal's program, black faces in high places is the way we solve these issues. So Sharpton, clearly under the gun, called up the black district attorney in front of everyone, you know, because he had to, you know, put on a show, and said, hey, man, what are you doing? You're throwing this case. We're all in the court. We see you going on. And then the black district attorney got mad at Sharpton and said, hey, man, don't tell me how to run my case. I know what I'm doing and stuff like that. Now, in reality, what happened is they were both putting on a front because they were caught in their own contradiction. Sharpton's program of black faces in high places was imploding. This Negro that he helped get elected in his position, he, like many other careerists, knows that if he goes tough after state, the iron fist of the state, like representatives, like the police, his career is finished.
Look at here, boy. You got to be tougher than on the police than that. You know, you were embarrassing and exposing me. And then the Negro district attorney was, well, what about my careers? If I don't go, if I go too hard, I's through. So what about me? I want to be rich too, you know.
So basically, both of them were caught up in their own contradiction. And at the end of the day, Amadou Diallo is being buried along with a track load of other black people who end up following that program.
And the cops went free.
Yep. So when he says, Sharpton, that it's not where you start, but where you're going, I agree with that in part. But if you're going from the plantation, not to freedom, not following the North Star like Harriet Tubman, but the master's house, then you ain't going nowhere, especially at the end of the day when many of us plan on burning it down. And if you in it, see ya. So Sharpton next wraps it up by actually singing, not only on Master's Plantation with Ray Charles, but singing in Master's house. This is what I mean.
I live in New York. I was there September 11th when that despicable act of terrorism happened. A few days after, I left home. My family had taken in even a young man who lost his family. And as they gave comfort to him, I had to do a radio show that morning. When I got there, my friend James Ntoumé said, Reverend, we're going to stop at a certain hour and play a song, synchronized with 990 other stations. I said, that's fine. He said, we're dedicating it to the victims of 9/11. I said, what song are you playing? He said, we're playing America the Beautiful. The particular station I was at, they played that rendition sung by Ray Charles. As you know, we lost Ray a few weeks ago, but I sat there that morning and listened to Ray sing through those speakers, oh, beautiful for spacious skies, for ample ways of grain, for purple mountains, majesty, across the fruited plain. And it occurred to me as I heard Ray singing that Ray wasn't singing about what he knew, because Ray had been blind since he was a child. He hadn't seen many purple mountains. He hadn't seen many fruited plains. He was singing about what he believed to be. Mr. President, we love America. Not because of all of us have seen the beauty all the time, but we believed if we kept on working, if we kept on marching, if we kept on voting, if we kept on believing, we would make America beautiful for everybody. Start November. Let's make America beautiful again. Thank you.
Now, it's true that on 9/11, a despicable act of terror did happen, and that the culprit should be brought to justice and executed, that this type of barbarity and terrorism, an act of cowardice, terrorism should never be allowed again. I'm talking about the September 11, 1973 coup in Chile by the CIA and the U.S. government over innocent people that ended up in the death of 30,000 Chileans. Where's some of the outliners for that travesty, some of whom are still alive? Where are they? When are their heads going to be on not only the auctioning block, but the chopping block of justice and stuff? So when you hear Sharpton go on and on about terrorism and stuff like that, and two of people who've been in the forefront of strange fruit terrorism, and not put it in the context that this is part of the American way of life. If you're not going to close the School of the Americas or fight to get it closed, which has produced almost all of Latin America's terrorist henchmen who then go back to their country and then terrorize their population to make their population safe and docile for Nike and Levi Strauss and McDonald's to come in and not worry about labor unions and stuff like that, not worry about health care plans, have young girls working 16, 18 hours a day on drugs to keep them awake, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, come on. Let's be for real. So having Ray Charles's song about America the Beautiful, that all that proves is that Ray Charles in reality was blind in more ways than one.
Yeah, but the good Reverend done outdid himself now, because I remember when Reverend Sharpton, Al Sharpton, tried to start becoming a reverend and leading demonstrations in New York. And, you know, I ran up to my partners. I said, y'all know this dude is FBI? Was the FBI informant? And they said, oh, now listen, this is how desperate black people are for leadership. They said, oh, Gerald, now come on, now give him a chance before you shoot him down. I said, well, I'm glad I live in California. I can't take that. Now, after a while, he did win the allegiance of a section of the black community. We have to recognize this dude has been successful in faking since the day he stepped on the stage. Every time there was a serious atrocity in New York, from that sister that got raped, you know, and
Tawana Brawley,
and I can go on and on. The cases that he has intervened in, always like a fireman, that is to come in and put out the fire.
And it's also because of the machinery, the way it works. Since black organizations at this time don't have autonomy, you know, there's not an independence autonomy, black organizations like the NAACP basically are an appendage of corporations. They survive support of the black community anymore. They survive off of Texaco and all of them making donations and stuff. So basically, they got one ear towards what Master's saying and thinking. So you have a situation where, with that corporatization of black organizations and independence and the consolidation of corporate media, whenever there's an outbreak within the community, they know just who to run to.
That's right.
Because within the construct of American politics at this time, those of us who have a critical eye on the role of the police, the role of the market system, et cetera, are deemed too extreme. And thereby, clowns, and they are clowns, like Bill O'Reilly, end up fussing with lightweights like Sharpton, thus giving Sharpton the illusion of credibility.
And prestige.
Right.
Although we must be aware that he ran for Senate in the state of New York and got 25% of the vote.
That's not too surprising. That's also within the petty bourgeois machinery, the Democrats, so on and so forth. He's within quote. Look, the mere fact that now everyone knows that we're not down with Nader, but Sharpton would get more votes than Nader, even though Nader, at least what he tries to outline as his little program, could be argued is much more progressive than Sharpton. So it's not any kind of salvation. But what I'm saying is Sharpton has a democratic machinery behind him. So Sharpton is allowed to get into all of these debates, while Nader, of course, is, you know, kicked to the curb.
Well, they would not let Sharpton run because he would pull black votes away from the Democratic Party. And the Democratic Party needs those black votes like a hog needs slop.
Well also, the mere fact that Sharpton and Jesse Jackson are so attached to the Democratic Party.
They ain't going to do it no way.
Yeah. I mean, the mere fact that when the 2000 election, black people went into uproar in Florida. They came out, started protesting. Jackson came down. Gore told Jackson to get out of town by sundown. And before the sundown went, Jackson was gone like a vampire. So next, the CNN corporate media gets into the act about the unscripted Sharpton act. So let's see how they start to frame things, and we'll take it from there. Dig this.
Al Sharpton was supposed to speak for 6 minutes. He wound up speaking for about 20 minutes. Judy Woodruff, this may have been one of the first unscripted moments of this convention.
We've been talking for the last two nights, Wolf, about what an organized convention and how it's been on time. Al Sharpton just hijacked this convention, at least this part of it. I would have to believe that the Kerry campaign is glad that this is not in prime time. It's after 8 o'clock on the East Coast, but it's not in the later part of the evening when more people are tuned in. He is fired up. He fired up these delegates, but I'm not sure this is the message the Kerry campaign wanted to go on this long.
And we should let our viewers in, Jeff, on a little secret. We got an advanced text of his speech, and it wasn't very much like what he delivered.
Well, it was kind of like the outline, and in fact, the person who is now going to rush to the mailbox counter is the teleprompter operator who was flipping the teleprompter. We could see this in the hall back and forth, desperately trying to figure out where Reverend Sharpton was going next. The more serious problem for the Democrats, you know, they all know that the broadcast networks come on at 10 o'clock. Everyone remembers Pat Buchanan in 1992 pushing former President Ronald Reagan out of prime time. Somebody's going to have to do some very fancy footwork to make sure that Elizabeth and John Edwards get their prime time shot, not to mention those retired generals and admirals. So this is actually, Judy's totally right. Well, this is the first moment in 3 days when the plan had slipped, and in terms of time, slipped somewhat dramatically.
And even though it wasn't at 10 o'clock when the three broadcast networks are going to be taking this convention live, there's still plenty, millions of Americans are watching this convention. And Judy, I'm not sure that this was necessarily the kind of speech the Kerry campaign wanted to see.
No, and, you know, they've been very clear this week. They want this convention to put out a positive message. Sure, there's going to be some red meat, but I'd be very surprised, and I haven't asked somebody this question. We certainly will do that tonight. I'd be very surprised if they wanted him to go after George W. Bush the way he did on Iraq, on statehood rights for the District of Columbia. I mean, he threw a lot into that speech. He obviously feels passionately. A lot of these delegates feel passionately about it, but I'm not so sure that it was, quote, on message for the Kerry Edwards ticket.
Now, you know what? This shows you how unsophisticated these so-called analysts they're supposed to be kind of translating what just happened to y'all. Let me tell you, you could not blow your nose inside of that convention without Kerry's permission. You think they let him go on 20 minutes and didn't know that they did? You think that was a slip-up? These people are the dumbest. I had to hold that back. I've seen in some time. In fact, what it is, and it's very obvious, actually, that's why I'm so surprised they could be so silly, is that the one thing that Kerry really doesn't have very much at all, he's not from the South, you know, and he's been in that Senate a long time. He ain't got no touch. He ain't got no engagement with the black community, but he needs those votes. They let Sharpton go on, hopefully, so they could have people say, oh yeah, you see they gave Sharpton some extra time last night. Yes, he carries all right, ain't he? Yeah, he's radical. Yeah, he let the Rev go on. Plus, to tell you the truth, it was noticed that 95% of the delegates support a withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan. They oppose the Afghan war. Now, that's his base. That's Kerry's base. He got to throw a bone to him some kind of way, make him feel that something militant was going to happen. Get the Rev. Go on and get the Rev. Let the Rev blow off some steam, and it'll be all good.
Now, I see the role of the corporate media. I don't see them as being as naive on that particular subject. I think that basically there's a controlling mechanism within the corporate media structure, which is tied to the interest of these multinationalist corporate conglomerates that are the imperial force for this nation. So you have a situation where anytime anyone is seen as broadening the spectrum of debate, they're going to come with their disciplining mechanisms for a gumpified population that is only too ready to, you know, thumb their nose up and get all upset with Sharpton and yeah, look how hostile he's being and so on and so forth. Since we have, unfortunately, a fairly unsophisticated populace at this time that is used to sound bites and things like that, this is what the corporate media harps on as a way of, in part, sending out a message to the Democrats that, look, you know what we're not going to tolerate. You know what happened to Dean? You know, he got up there flapping and was overconfident, and we just spanked him up and stuff. So this is, once again, the danger of the whole corporate media network. But next, here's...
Hold on, Tracy. You know, Tracy's absolutely right about that. I can confirm that this poison that these commentators are trying to push about not being too angry, don't be too radical. Let me tell y'all something. You need to be angry. If you ain't got no health care, you need to be angry. If you ain't got a raise in the last 4 years, you need to be angry. If you can't make your ends meet after you pay that extortionist rent, you need to be angry. This idea about, no, we don't want too much anger. No, we don't want to denounce nobody. That is coming from a wing of the bosses and the bankers and the landlords. That's who's pushing that. That's what they finance it. And unfortunately, it does filter to the common people. I'm on a couple of boards at KPFA, you know, and Pacifica, and I see little teeny-weeny little board members. These people ain't nothing. They ain't even a footnote in history. They be adopting this sick mentality, talking about, I'm too confrontational. I'm too angry. And I was wondering, where they getting that stuff from? There you go, that damn idiot box. There it is.
Next, here's Sharpton defending himself against, you know, the implication that he was bashing Boy George. So, less than 5 minutes after he did his little speech, there they were all on him. So let's check out what he has to say.
To the president. I didn't bash the president. I answered his questions. Never called him a name. I repeated his questions, and I answered those questions. That's not bashing. I think that's answering the questions the president tried to throw into the mix.
When you talk about why African Americans have been loyal to the Democratic Party as you did tonight, there are, of course, you've got, you know, three very prominent members of the Bush administration are African Americans. They do believe in him. You know, what makes the fact that there are African Americans that do believe the Republicans are on the right track?
They will then have to answer, then how do they explain what I said tonight? And that is that the advances we made under Democrats. We have not seen this president stand on the side of civil rights. In fact, he sent lawyers to fight against affirmative action in the Supreme Court. So it's not just about blacks having a job in his administration. His father appointed Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court. Many of us do not feel that that would help any Americans, in particular black Americans, in any way. We have the right to say we disagree, just like they do. But for the president to suggest that we're taken for granted and that we're not using proper political strategy, I think it would have been a betrayal of my civil rights background if I didn't answer that.
You rock it tonight. Thank you.
See, now, you just heard how we critique Sharpton. And basically, I don't have a problem with him, challenging, quote unquote, his adversaries or anything. That's what's part of a healthy debate. But within this corporate media spectrum, it's termed as bashing. It's like you're supposed to allow some fool to say whatever he wants as long as it's within the doctrine of the status quo. And you're supposed to meekly let it go by. Now, in many ways, this is, in essence, how Sharpton addressed it. Because, once again, he basically addressed it from a petty bourgeois standard. He didn't address the Abu Ghraib stuff. He didn't connect it with the Chicago Abu Ghraibs, you know, with Burge torturing black people, you know, putting electrodes
here,
in their genitals
in the
and so on and so forth. Or Abner Louima, you know, that type of
here.
Stuff. Or the prison industrial
the
complex.
States.
Or
right.
all of the aspects of people not being able to vote, obviously, during the 2000 election here. About how you have Dow Corning, for an example, who played a part in Union Carbide, poisoning hundreds of thousands of Indian people over in India. By the same token, they're poisoning thousands of women with their breast implants that are leaking all the time and on and on and on over here. In other words, there's corporate malfeasance that's tied in to both the Democrat and Republican Party that they know that's an area not to go in because that's part of the structure that they're a part of. So they'll get into this nuanced stuff and, you know, riding a donkey and all of that stuff. You know, you riding a donkey on Master's Plantation.
That's because you a damn donkey.
From one end to the other. But you free. You know, you just out of your mind. That's all. But
watch that donkey stuff.
Wolf Blitzerwitz wants a summation. So let's see how the people sum up the whole scenario. Check this out.
Thanks very much, Candy. Jeff Greenfield, button this up for us right now.
We have heard the most incendiary line of the convention, in my view, that if George Bush had appointed the Supreme Court in 1954, Clarence Thomas never would have gone to law school. He is, in effect, saying George W. Bush sympathized with the segregationists of the 1950s. That is way, way tougher than anything anybody said so far.
A lot of things are going to be written about this speech. A lot of things are going to be said as well.
Okay, so you heard them crying about Sharpton implying, in their words, that Bush Sr. was a segregationist and so on and so forth. I'm not going to even waste my time honoring all of that because, in reality, the Republican Party bought into a Southern strategist program. It got it from Strom Thurmond, who ran in 1948 under the presidency called Segregation Forever. That was his program. That's the only thing he ran under. And he used his delegates in the 60s to help pressure Nixon into buying in to that Southern strategist program, which Alderman himself says that it was meant to divide white Democrats from the masses of other Democratic supporters, blacks, young, so on and so forth at the time. So to polarize the Democrats under the banner of the young, the poor, and the black as not having family values, being anti-American, so on and so forth. From that standpoint, that's how they really ratcheted up war on crime, war on drugs. Family values was another one of their slogans. Law and order. All of these little cliches that you see from movies now, if you read the work of Nixon and them during that time, these were the same catchphrases that they were using back then. So the game is still the same, whether you're riding, like I said, on a donkey or on an elephant. Two animals that at the end of the day you're going to slip off on and they're just going to trample you to pieces. Hold on a sec. That's just going to about wrap it up for tonight. That it's clear that as long as we go around in circles playing this game of deceit by these fools that not only have a capitalist complex, but clearly a God complex, we're going to be in the land of basically a land of hell until the next time slave revolt.